Initially, I was going to stay, keep my face hidden. I was going to stay anonymous, but it didn't take long before I was contacted by so many people from around the world telling me how grateful they are that I can speak and I can share, the experiences of so many other people living under Islam. And that's when I started to feel ashamed, and I felt like, okay, these are people in Pakistan and Sudan and Somalia and Saudi Arabia and Iran, and they can't speak, but I'm in a free country. I should use my freedom
So
wisely.
where do you live? Which country do you live in?
So at the time when I published the book, I was in Canada. I don't want to share where I am right now.
Namaste and hello, viewers. I have a very special guest, Yasmeen Muhammad, with me. Before I have her give a brief intro, let me tell you why this is so important today. The world is in crisis, and Islam is at the center of this whole issue again. Before we dissect the current issue in the Middle East concerning Islam, I want to say that a whole lot of people are talking about it, but they either are practicing Muslims giving different points of view, or they are people who were never Muslims. They are Christians, Jews, Hindus, and so on, or atheists. But here we have a special person who's seen it from both sides. She was born a Muslim. She was raised a Muslim. She has some very important things to tell us why, what she faced, and why she left Islam. And she has been for many years, during her adult life, a non-Muslim. She calls herself a non-Muslim or an ex-Muslim, and is facing a whole lot of issues. So she gives a perspective we must know as one of the many perspectives. Because this is not being talked about enough. This particular point of view is not being talked about enough. So you're in for a real surprise, a real treat. We'll talk about first, I let her discuss her life, her journey, what her upbringing was like, what were the turning points, what she faced. And these are lessons for many other women who are still in Islam. Then we'll talk a little bit about the Israel-Hamas war going on in the Middle East. Then we'll talk about the global left. Why the global left is the way it is, why we have this whole Harvard syndrome and universities everywhere and media rabble-rousing people as liberators, what they're all about. We want to hear her perspective on this. And then finally, we'll talk about Islam itself. What is it about Islam? What are the qualities that result in these conflicts with others? And what can be done about it? And what should a non-Muslim like her or me, myself, kafirs as we are called, what should we do to survive, to thrive in harmony with Muslim people? Because we have so many Muslim friends. So with that kind of as a broad overview of where we are headed, let me invite Yasmeen to welcome to the show, Yasmeen, and please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thank you so much, Rajiv G. It's really, it's just, I'm so honored to finally be able to have this conversation with you. My mom and my dad were both very secular, open-minded people from the Middle East at that time. Was very common. Most educated people were secular, open-minded. The only time you would find very religious people, the only time you would see hijab or, people memorizing Quran is in the villages. I moved to Vancouver, Canada. And that's where I was born. And their marriage fell apart very shortly after. So my mom found herself in a new country with no support system, newly divorced, single mother to three children. And she started to look for community. She started to look for a support system. And she ended up going to the mosque, not because she was necessarily religious, but just because she was looking for some sort of community that was familiar to her, you know? And so she thought she might meet other Egyptian women or other Arab people that she could connect with. Well, unfortunately, she met the man who was caretaker of the mosque at the time. So he was an Egyptian man who was an extremist. Fundamentalist. He was very enthralled by the new thing that was happening at that time, which was this rise of political Islam or Islamism. And he pulled my mom along with him into this whirlwind of extremism. So suddenly at the age of between 5 and 6 years old, my life went from being a perfectly normal, you know, average Canadian child to suddenly everything was forbidden. Everything was haram. My mom had to start covering her hair, and we had to start covering our hair soon after, my sister and I. We were forced to memorize Quran. We were beaten if we didn't memorize it, because we needed to memorize Quran so that we could pray 5 times a day. We were told that we were no longer allowed to have non-Muslim friends. So my best friends, who, you know, I used to walk down the hallway in the apartment building where we lived, Chelsea and Lindsay, I used to play Barbies with them all the time. Suddenly, they were not allowed to come to my house. I was not allowed to go to their house. Birthdays are forbidden. Birthdays are haram. Riding a bike is haram. Swimming is haram. All joy. All the anything that a child would bring them joy and happiness at that age, all of it was forbidden. My mother's records, music is haram, music is forbidden. He took my mom's records. She had a lot of, she loved country music. She had a lot of Dolly Parton and Kenny Rogers and Hank Williams. He took all of her records and he broke them.
And now, Jasmine, what decade was this?
This was in the 80s.
So I just want people to know that this is happening. It's not something that's just happened nowadays, this radicalization. This story is not happening in the Middle East somewhere. It's not happening in Saudi Arabia or Iran or something. This is happening in Canada, and it's happening in the 1980s. And it's happening with her mom, who's a well-educated mm-hmm. person. And this is the amount of fundamentalism being brought into her life. Because the mother had a second husband who was this kind of a person. So it is now even more common. And the second point that is noteworthy is a secular family in Islam still wants to be in the mosque for social reasons. They didn't go there looking for religion. They got the religion imposed on them, but they went there looking for social companionship and, you know, people with similar culture, language, background, and so on. And they ended up with a whole lot of religion being imposed on them. Am I right in summarizing
this? You are absolutely correct. You know, I've detailed a lot of my experiences in my book. But let's just fast forward to being 19 years old, and my family forced me into a marriage with a man who is a member of Al Qaeda.
Your husband was a member of Al Qaeda.
Yes.
Okay.
He might still be. He's in prison in Egypt now.
Okay.
So before I was married to him, he was living in Afghanistan for 10 years working with Bin Laden. In fact, when he came into Canada, he was arrested because he entered Canada with a fake Saudi Arabian passport. Like, the amounts of red flags are inconceivable. So he is entering Canada from Afghanistan with a fake Saudi Arabian passport, and he is actually an Egyptian. Like, there's so many problems here, but they gave him refugee status. And not too long after we were married, I ended up pregnant. And I had a little girl. And you're a father, you know how you feel when you hold your firstborn and you're just overwhelmed with love that you've never felt before, this intense desire to protect this baby and for that baby to never feel anything but happiness in their life. And when I'm holding my little baby, my precious little, she's like a couple of weeks old, he leans over behind me and he says, "When are we going to take her to get her fixed?" And I said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "To clean her. When are we going to take her to clean her?" I said, "What do you mean clean her? She just had a bath. I don't understand." And then my mother says, "Oh, no, no, no. When she's maybe 6, 7 years old, then we'll take her to Egypt. And that's when we'll get it done." And then I realized that the two of them were talking about FGM. They're talking about female genital mutilation. They're talking about taking a razor blade to my perfect, beautiful little daughter and just slicing her genitals. And that's when I realized.
So for here I want to pause. I want to pause and paraphrase for my viewers. Some of them may not know the background. So female genital mutilation is a requirement in traditional Islam, where the genitals of a girl are mutilated, that this is irreversible for life, and this is part of the tradition. And why is it done? What's the logic that he would give? Is it just that this is the tradition, we do it, we don't argue, or is it that a female should be denied her pleasures and her sexuality, and because it's a male-dominated society? So what exactly is going on? What's your reason? I mean, as we are going, we should also interpret and not just give facts, but what are your reflections on why that is done and why that's so pervasive?
So you did hit the nail on the head when you said it already. It's a male-dominated society, and their point of doing this is to control women. It's to control their sexual desires. So they believe that if they cut off a woman's clitoris, then she won't feel any pleasure when she's having sex. So that way she will be easier to control. So I knew that I had to get out of that house before my daughter reached that age. You have to remember now, at this point, we're talking, this is about the mid-90s. I have no friends. I have no connections outside of this marriage with this terrorist and my mother. That's it. Those are the only outside influences I have. He has already not allowed me to sustain any kinds of friendships. And that's, of course, what abusers do to keep you controlled. I'm covered head to toe in niqab. Even I wear gloves and thick socks delivered from Saudi Arabia. I'm completely under his control. He has paper on the windows so that even if the curtain blows in the wind, nobody can see inside the house. So I'm at this point imprisoned, and I don't have any outside support system. But I know that I have to get out of here and I have to protect my daughter. That's all I know. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I just know I have to do it. Well, soon after that, I ended up getting pregnant again. And when I got pregnant the second time, I succumbed. I submitted. I said, well, this is it. How am I going to survive with a high school education, with no support system, with two children? I can't do this. And then when I went to go do an ultrasound, they discovered that the baby didn't have a heartbeat. And so I had to go in for a DNC surgery. And it was that moment that I realized it's now or never. If I don't get out of here with my one baby, I will never get out of here because he will make me pregnant again. You see, it is forbidden for a Muslim woman to say no to her husband because she is his property. So, you know, there's no way that I could stop him from making me pregnant again. And so when I went in for the DNC surgery, the nurse told me, when you wake up, because you're going to do a general anesthetic, when you wake up, you're going to need somebody to help you take care of your daughter for maybe 24 hours because you're not going to be feeling well. Well, I told him I'm going to need somebody to help me take care of my daughter for 1 week because I figured that would give me some time. And so, of course, as expected, he told me, go live with your mother for a week because there's no way he's going to help me with the baby for a week, or he doesn't know how to do anything with the baby. So I went to go stay with my mom for that week because I figured getting away from her was easier than getting away from him, less physically dangerous anyway. So when my mom got up the next morning to go to work, because she is the head of the Islamic Studies Department at the Islamic School, my mom is a Sharia scholar from Al-Azhar University. When she got up to go to work the next day, I grabbed my daughter, covered head to toe in black, took my baby, went on the bus, and I went to go see a lawyer. And I told the lawyer very quickly, I said, I have to be very fast before my mom comes home from work. I need full custody, I need divorce, and I need a restraining order. And this woman was like an angel. She completely did everything. She didn't even have the information correct because I didn't have the information correct. I didn't even have his birth date correct because they had lied to me about his age. He was 15 years older than me. Anyway, she managed to do everything for me. And I stayed at my mom's house. And I knew that he realized that I was filing for divorce when he came to my mom's apartment, and he was screaming from the front door of the building, screaming in Arabic, "Give me back my wife! I will cut your face!" And all sorts of threats. I was absolutely terrified. I called 911 and they told me, yeah, we know. Many people have called. There's a man, 6'4" man screaming in Arabic in front of the building. Okay, we're coming. So when the police came, they explained to me that a restraining order will only prevent him from coming, within a few hundred meters of where it was that I was either going to school, going to work, or living. And so they told me, for your safety, you need to stay in this apartment because we don't know, it's not a magic thing. It can't protect you like that. So I stayed under house arrest until CSIS, which are the Canadian CIA, until they contacted me and showed me a picture of him behind bars in Egypt. And they said, it's safe. You can come out now. Close to a year.
Okay.
I started taking the courses online at the time. It was a brand new
thing to have online courses. You stayed at home, isolating yourself and your child. Mm-hmm. You have one child that time. And to be protected until many months later, the Canadian CIA informed you that he's in jail as an Al Qaeda operator. Okay, you are at is your husband is in jail. You have a daughter now. What happens next?
So I start going to university, and in university I take a course called History of Religions, and it focuses on the three monotheistic religions. And so I feel very confident taking that course because I feel like I know Islam inside out. In that course, it was the first time in my life that I had the opportunity to actually critically examine Islam. I was allowed to ask questions and my professor didn't get angry. He encouraged the questions. And so while I was in that course, kind of being intellectually challenged about my religion, 9/11 happened. So when 9/11 happened, that emotionally challenged me. So I was bombarded both intellectually and emotionally at the same time. And so that's when I decided that I no longer wanted to be a part of this religion anymore. I didn't want to identify with the people who would be so jubilant over the deaths of people after 9/11. And that's when I left Islam. But of course, I stayed very quiet about it, because the punishment for renouncing the religion is execution. And that can be carried out by any believing Muslim. It doesn't have to be by some Islamic court. As you know, Ayaan Hirsi Ali is one prime example. Salman Rushdie is another example. People see what happens to people who go public and speak out against Islam. So I stayed very quiet to protect myself and to protect my daughter. And I stayed quiet for many, many years until 2014, when I was watching an episode of Real Time with Bill Maher, and he had a guest named Sam Harris. And the two of those men were talking about the problems within Islam and why the liberal left are unwilling to name the problems and unwilling to even criticize Islam, even though it was such an illiberal religion. And at that moment, everybody started attacking Sam Harris and Bill Maher, saying these are nothing but, white American men. They have no right to talk about this. And so I felt like it was I was compelled to speak out as a, brown-skinned Arab woman. And I would finally, I would be able to say the same thing as that they're saying, but they wouldn't be able to shut me down by citing my immutable characteristics. And so I wrote my book.
Okay, so this is available on Amazon, because I have a copy.
Yes, it's available on Amazon. It's available in 15 different languages. It's available through the Richard Dawkins Foundation website for free in Arabic, Indonesian, and Urdu. And yeah, so I published this book in October of 2019. Initially, I was going to keep my face hidden. I was going to stay anonymous, but it didn't take long before I was contacted by so many people from around the world telling me how grateful they are that I can speak and I can share, you know, the experiences of so many other people living under Islam. And that's when I started to feel ashamed. And I felt like, okay, you know, these are people in Pakistan and Sudan and Somalia and Saudi Arabia and Iran, and they can't speak, you know, but I'm in a free country. I should use my freedom wisely.
So where do you live? Which country do you live in?
So at the time when I published the book, I was in Canada. I don't want to share where I am right now.
Okay. Okay. But you're open, you're wandering, walking around, you're living a public life.
Well, I'm very careful about when I am doing things publicly.
So now tell us about the foundation you started to help other women, other Muslim women who want to get out, but they are scared. Tell us a little, just in a short way, why, just quickly, what it does. And so people who want mm-hmm. to support your foundation have a way to support you.
Yeah. So it's not just women. It's women and men. It's anybody who is looking for support from the religious trauma that happens from being raised in a Muslim majority country or in a Muslim family or in a Muslim community. And so what we offer is, you know, as soon as you renounce the religion.
Well, I think first you should give the name.
Ah, yes, of course. The name is Free Hearts, Free Minds. So it is encouraging people to free their hearts and free their minds and to be their authentic self. And when you renounce the religion of Islam, the first thing that happens is you lose your family, you lose your friends, you lose your community, you lose yourself in many ways. And so it is very isolating. And so what we do with our organization is we offer people both group therapy sessions as well as individual sessions and community support. So we allow them to have chosen family. They can be in a safe, loving environment where they can share their experiences, share their traumas, learn from each other, learn from experts. And then they can take all of these skills and it empowers them to lead their life in the best way that they want.
Those are the goals, but how do you accomplish? Is it one-on-one? Do you move them from home? Do you go to colleges and teach courses? What is your actual activity to achieve this?
So we have to be very, very careful because when we're talking about ex-Muslims, we're talking about people who are living in countries that can be executed for their beliefs. So everything has to be very, very quiet and we have to make sure that everybody feels very protected. So, and again, it's international, this is global. So we have it's eight group sessions. And in those group sessions, you'll have people from all over the world.
People who want to join approach you online.
Correct.
You give them a curriculum of several sessions. Some of them are individual, some of them are group. And these are on Zoom. And then what happens?
So after they go through the program of eight group sessions and four one-on-one sessions, and then they join a community where we all continue to support each other and celebrate each other's growth going forward, as well as help mentoring each other.
Okay.
So there will be people that have already been ex-Muslims for maybe a couple of years, and some people are fresh. We call them baby ex-Muslims. And so then one person will mentor another person and will help them through the journey because it's
somebody becomes a participant. Do they have to ritualistically, legally, formally give up Islam, or do they just, mm-hmm. is it a mental shift, but they pretend they're still Muslim outwardly? So these people they don't physically leave the family. They don't get divorced. They just continue living the normal life as far as other Muslims are concerned. But privately, you have given them a shift.
It depends. So sometimes people are living in America or Canada or Sweden or France or Australia, and they're safe to do that. But if it's somebody in Egypt or Saudi Arabia or Somalia or something, then, or Afghanistan, then they're not safe to do that. So they have to continue living a double life. Now, that double life can take on many forms. For some girls, it means that they have to continue wearing hijab. For some men, it means they have to continue going to Friday prayer. And to other people, it can just mean that they have to continue pretending to their spouse, to their husband or to their wife or to their children. So, you know, everybody is in a different situation. And it also depends on if they are living in a country that will imprison them or execute them for the crime of renouncing Islam, or if it's something that they can be a little bit more public about, but be careful.
So give us some statistics, like how many such participants have you had total, and a breakdown of which are the main countries.
So we just did it recently. We did a breakdown of the main countries, and the two main countries are Egypt and Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
But we have every one of the 50 Muslim majority countries, we have had people from there, even like Mauritania, anything, any country you can think of, we've had people from there. So it's important to know that, you know, this is, enlightenment is spreading. It's spreading to every single corner of this planet.
So how many people have you done this with, roughly?
We have been in session since 2017. So I actually haven't calculated, but it's, you know, it's thousands at this point.
So it is thousands. It's not like 50 or 100 mm-hmm. people.
No. But what is also important to note is that we are only able to serve about 30% of the people who contact us. We are not working at capacity. You know, we're very limited by funding. So we want, there are so many more people that we could be helping if we had the funds to be able to do so.
Okay, so we'll come to that, because I want to help you, you know, raise funds and things like that, because you're helping people. But I want some facts and figures real quick. So what percent are the men and what percent are women?
It's about 50-50.
That's very interesting that men also want to get out of Islam. Now, then how would you characterize their age in terms of what age in life are they?
And it seems to be the most popular is, you know, naturally from about 18 to 40 years old. Those are the two largest, like they're cut up into multiple groups, but those are the largest.
And would you say these are educated people?
Yes, most often they are educated people. This is, again, a limit to what we can do because it's on Zoom. So we have to be, and because it's in English, you know, soon we will be offering sessions in Arabic, but right now it's only in English. So even though we have thousands of people contacting us, we're only really, out of those thousands, you have to recognize that's only about maybe 1-2% of the actual ex-Muslims, because those are the people that A, speak English fluently enough to be able to be familiar with me and familiar with the program and be able to join us, and B, people that have safe, secure, private internet access where they can actually join in on the sessions, because it's very common that people can't do the sessions because their husband is in the house or their mother is in the house.
Sure. No,
or even their roommate is in the house.
Right. This has to be private. So how many instructors like yourself, I mean, do you call them instructors or coaches, the people who lead these discussions and guide them? What do you call them? Coaches?
We call them facilitators.
Facilitators.
And we have three facilitators. Yes.
So are they doing it part-time as a passion, or is it their full-time occupation with a salary and so on?
No, it is just a part-time, and they definitely do it out of passion. Like I mentioned, we don't have the funds to do that. If I'm not able to hire people full-time and with a salary, because we simply don't have the means to do that yet, but that is what I hope to do in the future.
So your limiting factor, because you have many thousands of people waiting to join your program and participate and become ex-Muslims, your limiting factor is what? Is it you need more facilitators and you need to be able to pay them? Is that the limiting factor?
That is absolutely the limiting factor.
So if you had the money, would you be able to find such facilitators, or how do you find people who can facilitate? I mean, do they have to be psychologists? Do they have to be trained in Islam? Do they need to know Islamic law? What are the requirements? Because tell the audience a little bit about what your sessions, the public and private, what kind of domains of expertise do your facilitators bring to counsel them?
So they are mostly clinical psychologists, but also social workers are also great people as well. And as far as the background, it is preferable if they do have some understanding of the culture, the different cultures that Muslim people come from.
Would you say is the, how many of the people proportionately, is it 5% or 50%, after going through your program, can say confidently that I am an ex-Muslim, versus people who took the program and said, you know, I decided to keep staying Muslim because what you told me cannot be done. It's too difficult. I mean, I cannot face it. It's too dangerous. So what? How many of them would you say are successes, where a success would be somebody who came to you to learn how to be an ex-Muslim and they achieved that?
So 100% of the people are already ex-Muslims before they enter our programs. There's okay. No way that we could ever allow Muslims to join our program because it's too dangerous. Right. We have to be very, very careful to protect people's safety.
Okay. So ex-Muslim, somebody who's already decided, I want to leave Islam. Now I need some resources, some friends, some advice and facilitation. So they come to you. Have you organized them into a group where they, like a group in Karachi or Lahore or a group in Makkah? Do you have these ex-Muslim support groups?
We do. Yes, they have them either on Facebook or on WhatsApp. They do it however they want to do it. And usually one of our facilitators is joined in the group as well. And they meet each other in real life, whether it, you know, it's in India or in Egypt, even in Saudi Arabia, we've had meetups. So yeah, it is wonderful to see the community growing and people supporting each other and reaching out and finding each other in real life. And I was lucky enough to join a meetup in Alexandria, Egypt, and to meet up with four people who have been through the program at a friend of mine's house, and it was absolutely beautiful.
Do you feel that it is safe for your alumni or people who are members to become a worldwide community? I guess they already are a worldwide community. You must have some kind of an online presence where people who are members can go. But is your website publicly known, so I could people who are interested in donating can go and look at it and check it out? Can you share the handle or the address of your website or your sure. internet or your Facebook handle or your Twitter handle?
Yeah, so it's freehearts.freeminds.com is the website. And then you'll also find us on Instagram under Free Hearts, Free Minds, and in Facebook under Free Hearts, Free Minds.
So, but you hide the identity of the members?
Oh, absolutely. If you go to our website and you click on testimonials, you will read hundreds and hundreds of stories from people who have been through our program. Where there's also a tab called Ex-Muslim Stories, where we go into more detail. So we tell the story there about a man who used to be one of the Taliban in Afghanistan, and now he is a free thinker. And he's been able to leave Afghanistan, and he's living in Pakistan now, which is, of course, not the best, but hopefully he'll get out of there soon. But we don't share anybody's real name. So many of the details, like identifying details, might have been altered a little bit. But we do write these stories along with the person to make sure that they feel safe before we put it up on the website. They know exactly what information we're sharing. And quite often people aren't even comfortable sharing the name of the country that they're living in. They just want to say Middle East. You know, they don't even specifically want to say Iraq or Yemen or whatever, because it's very dangerous.
So we've had a nice discussion to introduce your life story, to introduce your organization, and and I'm hoping people will go to the website, and I assume there's a donate button, they can donate.
Yeah.
Okay. So just for full disclosure, we sent a significant amount of money to her organization, Infinity Foundation did, because we do have we do have a certain fund for humanitarian causes. And you are IRS approved 501c3 in the United States. And maybe in other countries also, you have ability to be registered. I don't know. Where else besides USA are you officially registered as a government approved charity?
Only in America at this point, but we are working on doing the same in Canada.